Thank you, Maxie. It's been a real privilege to know Maxie and Fran, and say the same thing about your wife, too. Yeah, they kind of help make us, don't they? Yeah, we appreciate that. So thankful to the Brown Trail congregation for the invitation to be able to speak here and to be able to present some of the ideas that I've had and read and studied over the years about atheism and the dangers of it and the tragedy of it. A number of years ago, back in the late 1960s, or middle 1960s, I was going to Carlsbad Caverns and had our two little boys with us, and one of them, Alan, was about old enough to walk some and be carried some. And as we were walking down in the car in the caverns, we kept seeing these signs. It says, "Don't touch the stalagmites and the stalactites, it will turn them dark," you know, and I'd tell the boys, "Now don't touch them, it'll turn it dark, you know, so be very, very careful." Well, as you know, when you get to the bottom of it, we were standing there in line, and I knew they did it somewhere, but I wasn't aware when. I hadn't told the boys, and the guide started dimming the lights. And Alan grabbed around my leg and said, I didn't touch it. He thought that touching the rock, somebody's touching that rock, and it's growing dim in there, you know, it's turning it dark. And anyway, it was dark. When they got those lights turned down, that's one of the darkest dark, and they say you can put your hand right up there and can't see it, and I tried it, and you couldn't, you know. And, of course, both the boys were hanging on to us, and it certainly was dark. So he was sure that someone was touching the rock, that it was turning it dark. But as dark as it was, sadly there's a darkness that's far greater than that that's blinding so much of America. It's a darkness of the heart, it's a darkness of the mind, rather than a darkness of the night. And it's a darkness that leaves a man stumbling, can't see, in a world without hope, in a world without any purpose at all. It's a darkness that says, there is no God. There can be no greater darkness than that. And to those of us who believe in God and in Revelation and in the Bible, it's often difficult for us to understand why so many are eagerly accepting the idea of there is no God. Accepting so strongly and defending so strongly the idea of evolution, that there was no creator, but it all came about by chance. But that's one thing that amazes me about the Scriptures. The God of the Scriptures. Back in the first century, He inspired men to know that this would be true. To even see down to our day and time that multitudes would choose darkness rather than light. And when we look into the Scriptures and an understanding of the biblical reasons of why this happens, as God gives us such great insight into why it does, if we can understand that, it will not only deepen our own faith in the God of creation, but it also equip us to better rescue the many of those who are drowning in the dark waters of unbelief. It helps to know, it's helped me to know and understand that atheism is in most cases, and especially at the top, a far greater heart problem than an intellectual one. God understood this and He knew it, and He tells us about this in His Word. Atheists will deny it. They won't say it's a heart problem. They say it's a matter of intelligence and education is why we believe this. But God says differently. In Ephesians 4:18, having their understanding darkened. Why, Paul? Because of the blindness of their heart. That's where it begins. That's where atheism begins, the blindness of the heart. It's a heart problem. Romans, the first chapter, beginning with verse 21 and going through the end of the chapter. It says, they glorified him not as God. Why? Because their foolish heart, there's that heart again, was darkened. And what happened as a result of that? God gave them over to a reprobate mind. And they even became haters of God. Why? Going back to that foolish heart. Well, they didn't want to know the truth. And then finally, Psalms, the 14th chapter and verse 1. The fool has said, there is no God. That's not all that verse, is it? The fool has said, in his heart, there is no God. It's a heart problem. The word of the Lord also reveals of why the hearts of men prefer darkness. And if we're going to be able to rescue them from that darkness, we need to understand, why do men prefer darkness? There's a lot of reasons that the scriptures give, but I want us to look at three briefly. Number one, men love darkness that, John 3:19, men love darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. That's why so many accept atheism, don't want there to be a God, because their deeds are evil. I have a little book here, The Humanist Manifestos 1 and 2. And the Humanist Manifesto number 2 states in Articles 5 and 6, we affirm that moral values derive their source from human experience. That's where we get our values, from human experience. Ethics is autonomous and situational, needing no theological or ideological sanction. In areas of sexuality, we believe that intolerant attitudes, often cultivated by orthodox religions and puritanical cultures, unduly repress sexual conduct. The right to birth control, abortion, and divorce should be recognized. The many varieties of sexual exploration should not be considered in themselves evil. Short of harming others, individuals should be permitted to express their sexual proclivities and pursue their lifestyles as they desire. What did the scripture say over 2,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago? They loved darkness because their deeds were evil. And here it is. We want to be what we want to be sexually, and don't tell us what to do and how to live. Number two of why men prefer darkness. 2 Peter, the second chapter, verses, the whole chapter really, but verses 9 and 19 especially. Men love darkness because they despise government, are self-willed, and desire liberty. They promise the world liberty or freedom. Do they really do that? Is that why they love darkness? Because they despise government? Aldous Huxley writes, for myself, as no doubt for most of my contemporaries, the philosophy of meaninglessness, nothing means anything, was essentially an instrument of liberation. Peter said in 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 18 and 19, that these who despise government are self-willed. It says they promise them liberty. God knew the heart of those like Huxley hundreds of years before they ever lived. That evolution, no God, is essentially an instrument of liberation. I can do what I want to do. No government, no authority, can tell me how to live. He continues, it is a liberation from a certain political and economic system and from certain system of morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. That's from his book, Confessions of an Atheist, as quoted by Brother Bert Thompson. This manifesto, again, heartily agrees with the idea that men disregard God because they prefer freedom. People are more important than decalogues, rules, proscriptions, or regulations. We would resist any moves to censor basic scientific research on moral, political, or social grounds. We resist any move. Kind of scary, isn't it? Number three, why do men prefer darkness over light? Well, Romans tells us again in Romans chapter 1, verses 21 through 22, men love darkness because they are vain in their imaginations and profess themselves to be wise. They like to see themselves as the wisdom of the world rather than the scriptures and our God as the great wisdom. Humanist, atheist, see themselves as the only ones qualified to guide our world. Again, in the Humanist Manifesto, it says this, the next century, and we're not very far from that, are we? The next century can and should be the humanistic century. Using technology wisely, we can control our environment, alter the course of human evolution and cultural development, and provide humankind with unparalleled opportunity for achieving an abundant and meaningful life. Humanity, to survive, requires bold and daring measures. That's from the manifesto on pages 19 and 22. And so to many atheists, this new cloning of the sheep just takes us one step closer to directing our own evolutionary process. And this idea that Clinton has come up with just recently, you know, we're going to stop all of this, we're going to make a law and rule and regulation. Do you think it's really going to stop it? Do you think all these humanists and atheists are going to say, well, Clinton said we shouldn't get into cloning humans, so we're not going to do it? They've already stated that this is what our purpose is to direct our own evolutionary course. 30 years ago, this book was written in about 1977. It's the Young Readers Library, edited by Ruth Moore. But in the introduction of it, Theodosius Dobzhansky, professor of the Rockefeller University, wrote the introduction to it. Now, this is for the Young Readers Library, put out by Time Life. 30 years ago, listen what he is saying at the end of his introduction. The time is not far off when man will have to regulate his numbers and control the genes he passes on to his descendants so that mankind can remain healthy and vigorous. We must have knowledge and understanding in order to respond successfully to this challenge to survival. To help people, and who's this aimed at? The Young Readers Library. To help people gain such knowledge and understanding is the aim of this book. That was written 30 years ago. Do you think now that they're going to say, well, we're not going to clone humans, we're not going to do any of this? When 30 years ago they were already in the universities and writing for our young people that this is what their intentions are, their aim and their purpose is to take over the control of the evolutionary process? Little do they realize, it's not in man that walketh to direct his own steps, Jeremiah 10, verse 23. But men who love darkness, John the 3rd chapter in verse 20 says, they will also hate the light. They don't want us around. They don't want us having seminars, education, training for our young people or anything else, even ourselves, that would bring light into this world of darkness. They hate light. How much do they hate it? How true is it? Richard Dawkins is the author of 4 books, including The Blind Watchmaker. In 1996, he was honored as the Humanist of the Year, and his speech was recorded in The Humanist, July and August of 1997, on page 4. This is his opening statement of Richard Dawkins, Humanist of the Year, and this is recorded. But I think faith is one of the world's greatest evils, comparable to the smallpox virus, but harder to eradicate. Faith is the principal vice of any religion. That's how he starts out his acceptance speech for the Humanist Award. It's easily understood why such men seek to explain origins by the natural means rather than the supernatural means. They don't want God around. They don't want to submit to authority. They don't want to admit that there may be some greater wisdom than their own. There may be someone directing the universe that would take the control out of their hands. Robert Clark and James Bell, in their book, Why Scientists Accept Evolution, really bring out some good points in this, and I wish I had time to bring a lot of it to you. I don't. But here's one of the things that is talking about Spencer, of course, a well-known atheist. They say this, that Spencer's bias against the supernatural was so strong that he could not even think about the possibility of a supernatural manifestation. He didn't want to think about it. Spencer didn't. Like Darwin and Huxley, Spencer rejected the idea of creation and was looking around for something to take its place. He just didn't like the idea of creation, so what can we find so we don't have to accept it? That's when he fell in with a hypothesis of evolution. In a debate with Douglas DeWar on Is Evolution Proved, Shelton wrote this, I must therefore say quite bluntly that I regard the hypothesis of special creation as too foolish for serious consideration. Just to think about a creation, that's even too foolish to even think about it. What did it say about their foolish heart was darkened? I don't even think about it. Don't even study it. Don't even really see if it's true. I don't even put it to the test. And they claim to be scientists who test everything. It's the same attitude that's led many other prominent scientists and educators to reject the supernatural without ever even giving it this serious consideration. McGarvey is writing about Thomas Paine in his book, The Evidences of Christianity, on page 4. And McGarvey writes this, we have a striking example of this in the notorious Thomas Paine, who says in reference to the composition of part 1 of his Age of Reason, this is what Thomas Paine says, I had neither Bible nor Testament to refer to, though I was writing against both. That's how much serious consideration he took of the Bible and everything. He didn't even have a copy, didn't even look a copy, but he was going to degrade them and downgrade them and prove them to be untrue, even though he hadn't even read them, hadn't even studied them. In 1933, 34 men signed this Humanist Manifesto. Educators, supposedly. And it begins this. Let us notice how it begins. What I want to show is that evolution is accepted by those at the top mainly because they didn't want to accept creation. They wanted to reject creation, the idea of a God and submission to a God. And in this book, the first article begins, Religious humanists regard the universe as self-existing and not created. The very first short sentence in that first article is an attack on creation. Why? Because they must destroy that before they continue. The second article says, humanism believes that man is a part of nature and that he has emerged as a result of a continuous process. Notice, first attack creation, then we can accept evolution. It has to come in that order. They have to do away with the idea of God before they can go about their desire to destroy creation. This wouldn't be so bad if they were just doing it themselves, but they have such a strong desire to control education, universities, printing, movies, television, just about everything that you can imagine, to bring in the idea that there is no God and try to get people to accept that evolution is a proven fact without an intense investigation of the truth of the Word of God. And they've been so successful in so many ways. Jesus said that there will be blind leading the blind, and truly it's so true in our world today. Atheists are deeply committed to worldwide control of all of our educational systems in order to promote their doctrines. The 13th Amendment in this little book says this: religious humanism maintains that all associations and institutions exist for the fulfillment of human life, the intelligent evaluation, transformation, control, and direction of such institutions with a view to the enhancement of human life is the purpose and program of humanism. What? To control and direct our educational institutions. Paul Kurtz, who's the editor of the Humanist magazine, proudly reminds us in this manifesto that it was signed by, the second one was signed by 114 individuals whom he says were of prominence and distinction and has since been endorsed by countless numbers. John Dewey, known as the father of education, was one of the signers of the first of these manifestos. All the old Ivy League schools used to be proclaim God, and now they proclaim evolution. Not only has it started there, but it's filtered down even into preschools. Our children, from the time that they're born, exposed to television and little books and everything, are exposed to dinosaurs there from the idea of the evolutionary process on television and everywhere else. I want you to notice here the attempts that is made in the educational system to teach our children against creation. Ruth Moore, editor of this book on evolution, begins on page 6 with a picture of Darwin and says others had challenged the Bible's version of man's origin. This is a description of his picture. But Darwin puts creation firmly on a scientific basis. In the second paragraph, talks about his cruise. In the second paragraph, right in the opening pages, he was already finding strange likenesses and differences that the traditional story of creation in the Bible did not explain. The first picture, Toxodon. The discovery supported Darwin's theory that species were not created separately, but evolved from common ancestors. The second page. Most people literally believe the traditional story of creation, and Darwin did too, at first. The next paragraph. His own sensible arguments gave the whole study of natural science a new kind of foundation that explained life on earth more clearly than the church had. And it goes on. Ad nauseum. But the beautiful pictures we see on Channel 13, the Discovery Channels, how many of them start off with the idea that it evolved? That's just the way it is. And they want our children to swallow it hook, line, and sinker. Do you remember in 2 Peter, the second chapter, verses 18 through 20, it talks about how the world will allure Christians, uses the word allure, by promising them liberty. I kind of see it like the atheists stand up here with a fishing pole, you know, and they throw this out here. Little hook that says liberty, freedom, do what you want to do. And they reel it in, not just among the young, but among the old as well. And they throw it out and they reel it in. And it looks so good and it looks so beautiful. Freedom to do what I want to do. So enticing, so alluring. But isn't God marvelous when he gave us the information that this is what would be happening? 2,000 years ago when he says, they will allure you. With what? With liberty. Offering you freedom. Not realizing that they are servants of bondage. Servants of Satan themselves. But they do allure, and we need to be prepared for that allurement. As far as atheists are concerned, the supernatural account in the Bible has been put to scientific test by Darwin, by others, and it's failed. Most of them just accept that now. It's already been proven to be false. And so they don't search anymore. They don't look anymore. It's just ridiculous to even consider it. So natural science is now the new foundation upon to which to build the evolution of man. And sadly, so many are following in the footsteps which these scientists, which are supposed to have so much modern technology and so much wisdom, have uncovered about the real truths and the real origins of man. How sad it is that blind are truly leading the blind. But this shouldn't surprise us, should it? They're kind of touching the rock and turning it dark. What did Paul say in Ephesians 12? For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. It's nothing new. We need to be expectant, but we need to be prepared for it. It also says, many shall follow their pernicious ways, by reason of whom the way of truth shall be evil spoken of. 2 Peter 2:2. The picture looks pretty dark. But I was really surprised. As I was down at the library reading The Humanist, I went through a number of copies of The Humanist looking, and boy, some of the things they write in there are so scary, but are so full of holes if you know the truth and understand it. But they put in there one report that I found really fascinating. They went back to a sample of 19 and 14. And in The Humanist, July, August of 1997, the writer named Ed Doerr wrote this. He was having a study of belief in a personal God by scientists in 1914 and comparing them to scientists in 1996. In 1914, the percentage of scientists who believed in a personal God was 41.8%. By 1996, the percentage had dropped to 39.3%. With all of this teaching on evolution, I was surprised that even they report that in 1914, 41.8% scientists believed in a personal God. And after all this mass teaching, 39% of them still believe in a personal God after 80 years of intense teaching of evolution. So maybe even in the scientific world, it hasn't become as dark as we suppose. That's less than a 3% drop in over 80 years. Of course, it should have been the other way. So there's still hope in the scientific world. But of course, our greatest hope is from being strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. Ephesians 6, 10 through 20. The armor of God not only prepares us defensively, but it prepares us offensively to go out and meet the challenge that atheism lays before us in their teaching and in their doctrine, to show how erroneous that they are. The power of the gospel light is far greater than the power of darkness will ever be, but it must be preached. It must be taught. As atheistic evolution increases in popularity, how urgent it is that we go on the offensive. They've gone on the offensive. Look how far they've gotten and how many inroads they've made into the educational system in every area of life. We have great God-given truths that are designed to prick the heart and convert the souls. And these are the truths that our children must learn. They must be taught. And these are the truths that will lead others out of darkness into the light of God's Word. Let us look at a few of these truths that the Bible gives us. First, that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Genesis 1:1. Atheists must attack this. This must be their first point of attack. But how valid and reasonable are their arguments? What alternatives do they really offer us in this attack upon in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth? How much is their reasoning really based on scientific data and scientific fact? Carl Sagan and Ann Duran admit our beginnings, the key events in our early development, are not readily available to us. Our time depth is pathetically, disturbingly shallow. But this admission does not deter them from making the following imaginational story. On page 11 and 12 of their book, they say this: "Nothing lives forever. There was once a time before the sun and earth existed. Imagine you are a witness to that time. An immense mass of gas and dust is swiftly collapsing under its own weight, spinning faster and faster. It burst into radiance, a sustained thermonuclear fire. A son is born. 5 billion years after the events we are describing, these very atoms may be coursing through your bloodstream." That's right at the beginning of their book. And all the rest of the book is based on this imagination. But after a few pages, it's no longer imagination to them. It is fact. How sad. How sad. Back when I was in college, back in the 1950s and in high school, we would study and read these reports about the odds of a horse developing and these other things developing. Well, I thought surely they'd come up with something better than that, but even Carl Sagan, who passed away not very long ago, gave these estimates that the chance of life evolving on Earth is 1 to 1, followed by 2 billion zeros. It would take 6,000 books of 300 pages each just to write the number. Yet they believe it. And they laugh at us when we believe in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The second thing is that God made them male and female. Male and female created He them. Genesis 1:27. That's one of the greatest proofs that there is a God. That male and female developed by God at the same time. Can you imagine the impossible odds that a husband and wife and all their relationships just happened? Evolution over here was developing a man, and totally by chance, developing woman, so that at the same time, billions of years later, here we are, perfectly joined together. Wish I had more time to. I was looking through material this morning and found an old poem that I'd started years and years and years ago about a spider. And I kind of a little sarcasm, you know, and I just had a little verse here and there and everything. I never put it all together or anything else like that. But it made me stop and think again about the evolution of a spider. How could it have happened? What came first? This goo that he makes the web out of? Or the instinct to, well, now if I had some goo, I could make a web. You know? And then he had to have special feet once he got the goo to do something with so he could make a web. I mean, I can't make a web out of goo, can you? And then he worked and he worked, and in this little poem, he finally caught a fly. I don't know where the fly came from, but he finally caught a fly, and he finally got something to eat after all these millions of years, you know, because he caught a fly. But then it concludes with the idea of, you know, please, evolution, find me a mate. How impossible it is for all of this to have happened by chance. It couldn't have. No way on God's green earth. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. That's design. Notice how evolutions are still struggling with the idea that there is no designer. They say, during the next 50 million years, the early amphibians spread far and evolved into different species. And after a long time, mutation and selection again performed their wonders. They won't say God created, but they will say, boy, evolution performed its wonders. And I tell you what, that old evolution was a greater creator than almost God was when you see how many predicaments it got itself out of over all the years. God just had to speak and it was so. Evolution had worked millions of years to bring about these great wonders that Ruth Moore talks about in her book. Notice it says, perform their wonders. Some amphibians developed an egg. With its perfection, the egg-laying animals won their full freedom from the water. Wonder how long it took them to perfect that egg before they won their freedom from the water. God is so good to us, blessed us in so many, many ways. And one of the greatest, he's given us a book that says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And he's given us all the evidences that the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. How great all of this is, and how wonderful to live in a world where we have purpose, where we have hope beyond death, where we have a Savior that gives us standards of morality and rightness, that like it was said in Deuteronomy, the 6th chapter, that all the commands and ordinances that God ever gives. I love these four words. It says, tell your son this when he asks, why did God give us these commands, this book? The father's to sit down and say, well, God brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and he gave us these ordinances and commands for our good always. For our good always. Thank you.